Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
It's Tim. Tim's back, and it's like we're two wikis on just a rock in the middle of the ocean manning a lighthouse.
This is going to be an interesting hour here, I think. Yeah,
we'll... it's never not an interesting hour. It's what we do here.
But I digress. We will bond, and we'll try to kill each other.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Oh, yeah. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new disturbing drama.
Yeah, I wasn't really that disturbed, but there's a lot of WTF moments.
The new WTF movie, The Lighthouse. Yeah. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week. Although not really. We're going to finish off our list of the top five of 1999, and then we're going to kick off a whole new list.
Yes. It's all about lists.
The top five of the decade, and Tim will be the first to kick things off for that. First, though, I have to take my turn for the top five of 1999, and it's interesting going last. I do like to go last because I like to hear what everybody else has to say first, and I didn't want to like attenuate my list to be like I'm going to choose all the movies those other guys are. But I mean, some of it was, and that, and some of the choices I don't disagree with. I think. Any of the choices? I mean, even Peter choosing Big Daddy. I have sentimental reasons, admittedly, for his part, but that's okay. Yeah. So I'll start with my number five, which is The Iron Giant, which is Brad Bird did that movie. He also directed The Incredibles and Incredibles 2 and Ratatouille, but Iron Giant was kind of his big hit, although it wasn't a hit. I think it's sort of the last great example of cel animation. I mean, there were other traditional animations in that style after that, but I mean, in terms of story, in terms of character, in terms of emotion, in terms of the technicality. And it wasn't like all like hand drawn. Like the Iron Giant himself was a CG creation, but it's kind of the last grasp of that great art form, and it wasn't. I think maybe 4 years later that everything was CG city, and it's sad. Not that CG movies are bad, because they're certainly not. There are a lot of really great, but it's the passing of the art form. It's sad, and but at least we have this like sort of one great last relic in the Iron Giant.
Yeah, and we might go back in time to that too, right? Because there's always people who like to play with the retro, right?
Yeah,
you think of people who do stop motion nowadays and stuff. It's like they don't really need to do it; they're just doing it because they love it, and they, you know,
it could be like Kubo and the Two Strings. Like all it takes is like someone willing to sort of, you know, set the bank, and somebody like a director with a vision. Well, you know, and it's not like it's gone completely. There are still some kid shows, and you know, The Simpsons is still by and large cel animation, and Family Guy. It's still around, but in terms of like these big, bold animated movies, it's, and again, not to say that the CG ones lack artistry, but there is something about the craft. It is still, there's a I don't want to say authenticity, because that's the wrong word, but you know, there's a feeling you get from it that you can, you know, see the toil. You can see like it's like arthritic hands of the animators.
It's like editing film instead of video, or you know, like vinyl instead of you know, digital download for music.
That's right.
So I think there always could be movies that pop up, but we're in a whole different world now. You'd have to take a really powerful sort of producer or director to get something done like that, but you never know, right?
Yeah, never know. And I mean, John Lasseter did try to bring it back with The Princess and the Frog. I mean, that movie, It was a fine movie, but I mean, it was also kind of the last gasp of at least out of Disney anyway. But you're right. I mean, I think someone could bring it back at some point. It should be due for a comeback. My number four, and I can't believe Candace didn't bring it up, but maybe she just didn't want to be too predictable. But it's the Blair Witch Project.
Right, yeah.
Which I think holds up, but I'd be very interested to see sort of what maybe people experiencing it for the first time today think. Because it's very much a product of its time. At the same time, you can't recreate the whole thing where it's like, are they really disappeared?
Yeah. Cats out of the bag now.
You know, were these three people missing? That's harder to do on social media today because, you know, somebody says to their relative, well, I'm in this movie called The Blair Witch Project. And then you see the previews for The Blair Witch Project. It's like, oh, my God, are you dead? It's like, well, no, but I'm under studio contract to pretend I'm dead. But, I mean, so that, like, sort of infancy of the internet and the dubiousness. I mean, not that there isn't dubiousness on the internet now, but, you know, can you trust stuff on the internet? And, like, the whole thing of having, like, a website and that sort of viral the viral hype that was generated. That can't be done in the same way now. And, you know, we know it because they tried to do it with The Blair Witch, which was a sequel that came out, I think it's 16. And you had a really great filmmaker in Adam Wingard making that, and it just, you couldn't replicate. Even though, again, the tech has changed, so, you know, you can have characters wearing GoPros and, you know, having phones, and it makes a lot more sense than someone with a big camera walking around the woods recording everything. But you just can't. You can't. This is like one of the really most perfect examples of can't catch lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, and it's really cool. The marketing campaign, like you're saying, was really cool and really attracted so much attention. And it was a product of its times because a lot was made of how low budget it was at the time too. And I think of the dog movies and there was a time where it's like, okay, we're going to try to do something just on video and just, you know, we're going to be constrained. Our resources are going to be constrained and we're going to do this. And yeah, it was great how they made it go viral back before we had Twitter and Instagram and all this stuff that we have now.
It invented virality.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what it was called, but it was definitely that. And, you know, there were, like, it was on Space, like, the special, like, The Curse of the Blair Witch. And it's like, is it real? Is it not real? do you dare go into the woods in Maryland? Because you could, you know, disappear, too, and people leave freaky rock formations all around. It's, I watched it again before this. And I watched it again a couple of years ago when I was actually interviewing a couple of the people who were in – I interviewed one of the directors and one of the actors, so I can confirm he's still alive.
And he's an actor.
He's an actor.
You can confirm
I can confirm he's an actor. But I remember, like, putting it on it. I was working at Thomas at the time, so I put it on when I was working on a Sunday night. And, of course, it was dead and you can't help but get, like, that eerie feeling. And I was walking home, and it's, you know, like, after having the Blair Witch on and people screaming. And and it definitely does have that effect. And, I don't think we'll ever see its like again.
No, but I don't know. I mean, maybe, like, there's so much misinformation on social media that people believe nowadays that you never know. Maybe it might. But like you said, after a week, probably the cat would be out of the bag. But
now that you mention that, I do wonder if there's a way you could sort of capitalize on, like, the fake news culture and turn that into, like, an interactive movie experience like this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that may be up to someone more clever than me.
Yeah. I could see a they were saying Blair Witch was like a documentary, right? But I could see a documentary just with so much misinformation now, and, you know.
Yeah. It could happen. So my number three choice is Election, which is the Alexander Payne movie. I think it's probably even more relevant now. It's interesting after, you know, sort of 2016, and there's been a lot of comparisons between the 2016 U.S. election and the movie Election, because you have an ambitious blonde woman running to be president versus Although, you know, going back and rewatching it, Chris Klein is not a Trump analog at all. Not that he was in the first place, but the Chris Klein character is generally good-natured, generally well-meaning. But it is very... The commentary now is even more pointed about how unseemly female, you know, female power is, and the desire for a woman to have power. And watching this again, I really try to challenge myself to not fall into, because, you know, when you watch the movie for the first time, it very much falls into the, you're rooting for the Matthew Broderick teacher,
right? Because
you're seeing Tracy Flick through his eyes, even though the film doesn't like explicitly make it from his point of view. It's very much from like the united points of view of all the characters, because they all have their turn doing a voiceover. But it's really interesting to try and watch this through not necessarily a sympathetic view for Tracy Flick, the Reese Witherspoon character,
right,
but just like separate yourself from all the which is hard, because it's also a point of view movie, as I said. It's all the voiceovers.
Right, and it's like, I haven't seen it in a while, but it's like she's portrayed as like this total bitch, right? Basically,
in a lot of respects. Yeah, it's I think that's a read on it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the direction that Alexander Payne goes in.
Yeah.
I think it's very sort of neutral towards her. I think that comes from bringing your own preconceptions into it. It's interesting to sort of try and.
But the, like you're saying, from the point of view, because you're seeing these point of views so much throughout the movie.
Yeah, the Matthew Broderick teacher is like, she's going to destroy, like, she's going to destroy the world. And it's like, no.
Yeah, he's just paranoid, right?
Yeah, it's just like, she's just a regular kid who, you know, has ambitions. And she's she's an only child raised by a single mother. The single mother has clearly put all her ambitions on top of Tracy's own ambitions. And, you know. It's really, really interesting to try and unpack all that now, and to try and unpack like frankly the misogyny, and that's not necessarily the you're a bitch, you know, explicit version of misogyny, but like the preconceived notions we have, especially about that whole point of view about the unseemliness of female ambition.
Yeah, and I think Alexander Payne, he's a great director. He's really into the humanity of characters in all his movies that I've seen, right? He brings out the best in the performances. I remember really liking Election, and then he's gone on, obviously. Like, he's done The Descendants, Nebraska. They're just such great films.
Yeah. About Schmidt, too, which is like the last great Jack Nicholson performance. Yeah. He's still alive. I just want to say that. Jack Nicholson's still alive. So my number two was also Vince's number two, although Vince got to it before I could, which is Three Kings, the David O. Russell movie, about soldiers trying to steal Kuwaiti bullion in the last days of the Iraq War. I think we talked last week about how it's like it's not a war movie; it's a war satire, which was why it was not terribly successful. You know, it has George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg in it.
Yeah.
But it's really very sort of nihilistic with its point of view of war. Actually, I think nihilistic is maybe the wrong word. It was just this thing that happened, which is kind of like the subtext. And everyone's like, because everyone's talking in the movie, it's like, what did we do here? It's because it's about Gulf War One. Yeah. It's like, what was the point of all this? And that seems to be like the great question. It's like, what is the point of this?
Yeah.
You get varying points of view. You get, you know, various ideas overlapping, and, you know, it's at its heart, though, really an anti-war movie. It's just really, really subtle and, you know, acid-tongued about it, because there's this one point where the George Clooney character explains like the effect of a bullet on the body, and it actually sort of shows that in this like sort of CSI detail about what happens when a bullet goes into the body. And it's really grisly, but it's also really informative, especially since the movie starts out with Mark Wahlberg on patrol, and he sees an Iraqi soldier, you know, waving his hands up, and he says, or, you know, he looks to his left at the other soldier. He's like, so are we still shooting?
Yeah.
And it just breaks it down. You know, it takes this, the whole idea of like the, we're out in the desert killing bad guys, and really breaks it down to like the human, like grisly and anatomical cost of what a bullet. Mm-hmm. And then that just puts everything, like for the every time you see a shootout in the rest of the movie, because it's this is before there's been any sort of like real action, but every time you see a shootout, that scene phrases the action.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really powerful, that, you know, when you whenever somebody pulls out a gun,
yeah,
your mind goes back to that scene of that bullet firing through a torso.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because in so many films, people are just shooting willy-nilly, and it's just like, okay, that's just par for the course, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And, yeah, that's great at just showing what the consequences are of that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're running out of time, but I do want to get to my number one. Speaking of shooting up people, The Matrix.
This one has some good shootouts.
The Matrix is my number one, and I thought about Fight Club, but I also wanted to like put in something that was like kind of for me, and that was kind of fun, and it was kind of, it really was like, I think for the 90s, it was kind of like the Star Wars. It was like, mm-hmm, the moment where the blockbuster was kind of rephrased, and mm-hmm, you can see the Matrix influence on just about every major movie going forward, whether that you get into the Bourne Identity series, mm-hmm, and you have Matt Damon having to work out for months to sort of do the action scenes, using a stunt double very, very sparingly. Bullet Time, everybody was copying Bullet Time.
Right.
The cyberpunk aesthetic, the martial arts, sort of, you know, it was one of these movies that everybody borrowed a cue from and really set the tone for, you know, what was to come in the next, I'd say even, you know, 20 years. Mm-hmm. That it's really, really, really one of those movies that, you know, you can stick a pin to it on the artistic map of,
for sure,
of cinema output, and say this is a moment that changed everything.
Yeah, hugely influential, and I watched it recently again, and it stands up, right? You're just so energized after watching it too. It's just such an electric movie. It's like, yeah, it's just, yeah, one of the best. What genre you say, like science fiction movies? Probably one of the best science fiction movies I've ever seen.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really good.
Great characters, great action, great world building, great effects. It's all there.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and then change the tune and start our top five lists of the decade. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRE.
Administrative board hearing. You're being accused of intentionally breaching security, violating copyrights, violating individual privacy by creating the website www.facemash.com. You're also charged with being in violation of university policy on distribution of digitized images. Before we begin with our questioning, you're allowed to make a statement. Would you like to do so?
I've already apologized in the Crimson to the ABHW, to Fuerza Latina, and to any women at Harvard who may have been insulted, as I take it that they were. As for any charges stemming from the breach of security, I believe I deserve some recognition from this board.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
I don't understand.
Which part?
That was a clip from The Social Network, which came out at the very beginning of the decade in 2010. The behind-the-scenes story of Facebook. And I was listening to a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and all that. And somebody said he should write a thank you note to Aaron Sorkin for that movie. For a moment, there was this heroic portrayal of Mark Zuckerberg. It wasn't like he wasn't like the perfect hero.
But definitely not the perfect hero. Like, but even in that clip there.
Even in that clip, but it's, you know, he was sort of like this, the new digital pioneer, you know, swashbuckling hero type that, you know, we've come to lionize a lot. But, you know, in the last couple of years, we've all become Winklevi. Anyway, I don't know if Social Network is on your top five, but maybe we'll see. Why don't we start with your number five?
Okay. Yeah, my number five of the decade, and it's tough to keep track of decades. It's 2010 to 19, right? I didn't even know it was the end. Now I know. Because what do we even call this decade? The tens?
To be determined.
Yeah, okay. At least now we'll be in the 20s, so it'll be
good. Yeah, that'll be easy. Yeah.
It'll be a lot easier. My number five, I picked the first film I reviewed on End Credits. It's called Madi.
Oh, yeah.
From it. It says on Wikipedia from 2016, we reviewed it in 17.
Yeah.
It was one of those slow burns. I think it opened at some film festivals, and then it was re-released the following year.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and it's an Irish-Canadian co-production directed by Aisling Walsh, who's Irish, but is written by Sherry White, a Canadian screenwriter, and stars Sally Hawkins, who I hope she keeps doing great films, because I think she could be the next Meryl Streep, really, because she's an excellent actress.
Mm-hmm.
And her portrayal was of folk artist Maude Lewis from Nova Scotia, and I thought her portrayal was excellent. And I rarely respond emotionally to a movie like I did to this one, so I'm like, I have to put this on the list. It's a great story of her situation in this small, tiny house with her husband, who's a fishmonger named Everett Lewis, played by Ethan Hawke.
Who was also great.
Yeah, who was also great. And he's abusive, but still she loves him for whatever reason. It's
a challenging relationship. Yeah,
challenging. And it's interesting because in this small house, she has health issues. She can't leave. She's in there and she just paints.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great film about someone who creates art because she has to, basically. This is what she loves to do. She's found her passion, even though at the time she wasn't making money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
But she found her passion, and her vision really extended beyond her cramped space. So her vision really transcended her environment. And I thought it was just an excellent film. And I would have probably, if I had the power, have nominated Sally Hawkins for that movie and probably Shape of Water, because I thought that was an excellent year for her.
Mm-hmm.
The movie had no Oscar buzz, no Oscar nominations, but I know it did sweep the Canadian Screen Awards when it came out, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Even with an Irish director, because that's the way we do it in Canada. It's like, okay,
yeah.
Canadian subject filmed in Newfoundland, so
yeah.
It counts.
I remember that controversy that it wasn't filmed in Nova Scotia. It had to be filmed in Newfoundland.
Yeah, because like, the tax credits
the
were
tax
no more.
The tax credits were more substantial. Another typical Canadian story.
Yeah.
All right, number four.
Number four for me is The Lobster from 2015,
yes.
Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos from Greece. A very interesting director who's gone on to do interesting work he did before this and after this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just an awesome film that I watched actually on Netflix. I didn't see it in the theater when it came out. And I just clicked on it, looked like an interesting film, and I was like, wow, this is like nothing I've ever seen. Absurdist black comedy where single people have 45 days to find a romantic partner,
yep.
Or otherwise they're turned into animals. And it was like nothing I've ever seen. It's deadpan, hypnotic, moving. And I think I read some reviews recently about it, and they were saying, oh, it's very contemporary, very of its time when it comes to having to hook up with people, you know, getting into that monogamous relationship, and how do you get there in the first place? And there's talk of Tinder and dating sites, but I think it's really timeless. It's, you know, how the expectation is for people to be in monogamous relationships. How do they get into it? How, you know, the clock's ticking often.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really cool. And Colin Farrell is amazing in it. And Rachel Weisz is amazing as well. And they're trying to hook up in this strange environment. And they're like falling in love for real in this strange environment where people are hooking up to pretty much to save their lives. So they don't become a goat or a lobster or a rabbit or whatever.
It's strange because the way I read that is that the whole thing about being turned into an animal is all, like, it's a commentary on like dating modern, you know, going on social media and everyone's in relationships and everyone looks happy and everyone's, you know, having cool lives and being out there, and you know, you feel like, well, maybe I should just be turned into an ant or something, you know. what am I doing just, you know, sitting at home on Saturday night having a can of soup or something? I think that whole thing about turning is a commentary on that, that if you are not in a relationship, you are nothing, and then you have to broadcast your relationship all over the place. You have to change your relationship status and all that, so.
Yeah, so I thought it was really timely commentary. At the same time, it's so odd. I think it'll just be a timeless film.
Yep.
So I expect years from now we'll talk about The Lobster.
maybe.
Number three on my list is Lady Bird from 2017. And this one I think is timeless because I was struggling. I think maybe 10 years from now it would be number one on my list. Mm. But right now I have it number three, written and directed by Greta Gerwig her solo directorial debut. And it's set in one of California's least glamorous cities, Sacramento, California. So
it is the capital, though.
Yeah, but yeah. And it was in the early 2000s, the early aughts, 2002, 2003. And it's like no coming of age high school movie I've seen. I just thought it was real, yet the lead character was so eccentric, which was really cool to watch. And Saoirse Ronan was just amazing. I would put her up there with Sally Hawkins in my book as the going to take Meryl Streep's crown one day.
Yeah. It's her. She's sort of taken that, maybe even the Kate Winslet slot, because Kate Winslet was like habitually just nominated for Oscars, and I think the same thing has happened to Saoirse Ronan as well.
Yeah, and I thought it was amazing, and it just made you feel like, okay, this is something that's really happening, and you saw like the alienation, and there's a great scene where I think they're in the car and they're playing the Dave Matthews song, and you've got the guy in the back played by Timothy Chalamet, who's the cool kid in school, right? And the girls like him. He's attractive. He's sitting in the back just dissing on this song, but yet it's one of the protagonist's favorite songs. And, you know, it just shows just how, you know, how hurtful it can be in high school when you're different.
Yeah.
and she's very different because she takes the nickname Lady Bird. Her real name's Christine. And I just thought, like, it just hits on so many points about what it's like to be in high school, what it's like to be in a city like Sacramento, which isn't like...
it's not hip.
Not a hip town. It's not like San Francisco or New York or something, right? It's like...
almost literally sandwiched between San Francisco and Los Angeles. So.
Yeah, it's just this, almost
the Central Valley where nothing cool happens.
Where you go to the local mall for something to do, kind of thing.
The beach is a 5-hour drive away. It's not like the best part of California for sure.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to see it again. All these movies I've seen once that I've mentioned so far, I'd definitely like to see that again because I feel like it was an instant classic, and I think it'll be. Talked about for years to come as well.
You could be right. You're number two.
Number two on my list is from the same year, The Shape of Water.
Oh, yes.
And by Guillermo del Toro. I just thought this was just a beautiful love story by, you know, Guillermo del Toro, who's into, you know, science fiction, and it's like a variation on Swamp Thing or the Creature from the Black Lagoon sort of thing. And it was filmed in Ontario, which is really interesting to watch.
All over Ontario.
Yeah. And it was actually the diner in its Lakeview in Toronto, which is just something that's really, really cool. And I just loved it. And so once Sally Hawkins once again plays mm-hmm. the mute mm-hmm. who works in the secret government laboratory in Baltimore and during the Cold War in 1962. And she's just amazing in the movie, and in a very different movie than Maudie, where, you know, there's a lot of dialogue. You know, this obviously there isn't. She's just so much with facial expressions, with physical acting, and talking about physical acting. The creature, Doug Jones,
yep,
does an amazing job as the creature. I felt as well.
Mm-hmm.
And great supporting roles. And it just shows, once again, outsiders, very much like Lady Bird in a way from the same year, just what it's like to be an outsider and, you know, trying to find love and happiness as an outsider.
It's funny, and I'm just thinking of this now, I think Shape of Water came out the same year as the Disney Beauty and the Beast,
yeah,
where it's like, typically in these stories, it's very subtextual, the romance. And in Shape of Water, it is very text. It's very mm-hmm. sexual.
Yeah.
It's very explicit, like not explicit in like a pornographic way, but it is like very, very obvious that there is not just a romantic connection between her and the Gill Man, but that mm-hmm. there is a sexual connection. Yeah. And that is remarkably bold.
Yes.
And it like, honestly, it shouldn't have been. And I appreciate that Guillermo del Toro went there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what kind of sets it apart and it makes it memorable. It's not just a Beauty and the Beast style fable. It's like they are real characters who come complete, including with a sexual relationship.
For sure. And when they're making love, I remember watching it in the theater, and it was like half the audience, me included, was like, wow, this is...
He did it. He freaking did it.
Yeah, but then there's other people who you know, were laughing and said, what is this?
Yeah.
And it pulled them out of the film. It broke down the fourth wall in a way or something. But I could see that divide. But I think if you're invested in it, it's a great you have romance.
You have to be invested. And I tell this story a lot, that I remember seeing Brokeback Mountain. And this was like after the Oscars came out. I went to the bookshelf with a couple of friends and we watched Brokeback Mountain. And after the first sex scene between Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal, like a couple of people got up and left, and it's like, I can't believe there was gay sex in Brokeback Mountain.
How dare they?
It's like, well, it's kind of what the movie is known for. And I think that's kind of where The Shape of Water will always be remembered as, that movie where the human lady and the gill monster had sex. But
yeah,
I digress. That brings us to number one.
Number one on my list is Birdman from 2014.
Oh, yes, Birdman. Iñárritu. I don't think you can do a list of the decade without an Iñárritu.
Yeah, Iñárritu. And something I just noticed when I put this list together, Shape of Water, Mexican director, Birdman, Mexican directors. So Mexican mm-hmm. directors make the best American movies, I think.
Yeah, complete with Alfonso Cuarón. You're talking about even Gravity, which is like kind of a popcorn movie.
Yeah.
Roma, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a good decade for Mexican directors.
For
sure. At least three of them.
Incredible movie, Michael Keaton. But I really loved Edward Norton in this movie. I thought that was him at his best in this. Just as this cocky, you know, arrogant theater actor.
Yeah.
Who can do no wrong. He brings, what is it, vodka? He has real vodka on stage when it's supposed to be fake.
That's
and he's
right.
getting drunk while they're
rehearsing. Yeah.
And Emma Stone, Naomi Watts, just a great cast. And it was... Keaton plays a faded Hollywood actor who's best known for playing superhero Birdman. So mm-hmm. similar to him being Batman, right?
Yeah, but it was wink, wink, yeah.
Yeah, wink, wink, nod, nod on that. And he's trying to be taken seriously with this Broadway adaptation of Raymond Carver. And you feel for him because he's trying to do something different, more artistic. And everyone knows him just as Birdman. Hey, Birdman, you know, walks down the street. You're Birdman, right?
And of course, he's literally haunted by the Birdman persona.
Yeah, yeah. He always sees him and you're not sure, is this really happening or is it a figment of his imagination? Or
yeah.
What is it? And it's just an amazing film. And I was thinking, too, the score is so great. It was just the jazz drums.
Yeah.
Whiplash was a great movie. And I think of this movie, though, I think, like, wow, this had the jazz drums as well. And it's not it's not a movie about jazz drumming, yet the score is just so terrific.
The score matches like the tone of the movie, which is also so scattershot, and it feels like it's being made up as it goes, even though it's like very coordinated because it's all meant to be done in a single shot. And then of course, there's no way it was done in a single shot because I think it was shot in a couple of different theaters too.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't even just set in the one theater. The score definitely helps set the tone.
Mm-hmm. And something that's interesting, a movie I saw before I saw Birdman is called Game 6.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of the elements from Birdman are taken from Game 6, which is weird because Game 6, I think, you look on Wikipedia, did like $100,000 box office.
Right.
Yeah, I think the filmmakers and writers of this were inspired by that. Michael Keaton, once again, a playwright in New York, Broadway. And there's one critic who can destroy him, and it's played by Robert Downey Jr. in Game 6.
Right.
So I'll give a shout-out to Game 6, which is not nearly as good a movie as Birdman. It's imperfect, but I do like it. It's sort of a cult film from, like, 2005, 2006. And watch that and then Birdman, and you'll see how Birdman was inspired by that for whatever reason. A movie very few people saw, but they continued it, so I can't wait for the next movie where Michael Keaton plays a playwright.
He needs to finish the trilogy.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. We're not getting into that this week, but the next movie we're going to review, well, there'll be some stuff to say about that. Whether or not it makes Tim's list, maybe by the end of the year, we'll see. We're going to come back with a review of The Lighthouse. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
I mopped and swept twice over,
sir. You lying dog.
I swept them.
Tis begrimed and bedabbled. Unwiped, unwashed, and disdained.
Get some kind of pert out of molesting me.
Come now.
I already says...
How dare ye contradict me, you dog?
Now look here. I ain't never intended to be no housewife nor slave in taking this job. And it ain't right. These lodgings is more ramshackle than any shanty boys camp I ever seen. The Queen of England's old fancy housekeeper couldn't even done no better than what I done. Because I tell you, I scrubbed this here place twice over.
And I say you did nothing of the sort. And I say you swab it again and you swab it proper like this time. And you'll be swabbing it 10 times more after that.
And that was a clip from The Lighthouse. It is the new film by Robert Edgars, and it stars Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. Pretty much a two-person play with Willem Dafoe as arguably the sea captain from The Simpsons. It's
Willem Dafoe. There is no over the top for Willem Dafoe. He just goes there, which is awesome.
It is like just this brazenly. It's almost cartoonish performance, but he makes it work.
Yep, for sure.
I have no idea how, I have no idea why, but seeing him talking about swabbing the deck and ye scurvy dog and
he's got the peg leg. He's got every stereotype right there.
Yes, it is every stereotype. But it freaking works.
Yeah, he's so intense, his performance. And I couldn't understand what he's saying. Sometimes it's like watching like a Shakespearean play at certain moments. Like, probably my favorite scene is Robert Pattinson, his character, Winslow,
right.
He's known for most of it, is his real name's Thomas, I think.
Yes, but that's a reveal later on.
He he insults his cooking, right? Because yeah. Willem Dafoe's character, who is Thomas, is doing this cooking, is doing all the cooking, and he's insulted by it. And then he goes on. It felt like for 5 minutes. It's probably like a minute.
Right.
This like Shakespearean soliloquy about his cooking and how he takes pride in it. And the camera gets right up on him. And Willem Dafoe, such an interesting face. You see his eyes bulging, his mouth, his weird teeth. He's got this big beard. And he is just so intense defending himself.
That's the Heart King Neptune scene where he like curses Pattinson.
Yeah.
And it's so mesmerizing because it's like the camera's like right on his face.
Yeah.
And because of the weird shape of the aspect ratio, it's a box, very much like Ghost Story, which we reviewed a couple of years ago. But so his face literally fills the screen.
Yeah. There's no escaping from it.
And so he's just like rattling off this like Mariner's curse of like, because he's insulted the cooking. And, you know, if you're alone in a lighthouse for like a month, your chances are the cooking isn't great. But still, like, it was just like an affront.
Yeah.
And he like, it goes on and on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the funny thing is then Robert Pattinson, like the comedy, the timing's perfect. Because then right after this long speech, he just goes, "Oh, your cooking's not bad, actually."
<You're> right.
Something that, in fact, is actually pretty good, your cooking.
Yeah. All these scenes, when you kind of get into the second half of the movie, where it is them having been stranded at the lighthouse because of the storm, and it's all these scenes where something is said or something is done or something isn't done, and the tension goes up and up, mm-hmm, and up. And then sometimes there's like this burst of like this, like the Hark Neptune, or there's like a fist fight, and then it goes right back to they're friends again.
Yeah, aren't they? usually alcohol helps.
Alcohol, yeah, solves conflicts, yeah. Interestingly. It's bizarre. It's just bizarre. There's some kind of commentary about male relationships there, because there's this one scene where they're kind of, you know, slow dancing with one another. And then, yeah, that escalates into like a fist fight, and then it cuts to like a little while later and they're kind of like snuggled together, yeah, on the floor.
You're like, did something just happen?
Right. It's just, yeah, something's being said, and I'm not entirely sure what, but I think it has to do with like male relationships. It's not quite broke back, but it is saying that, you know, something about like maybe the toxicity or the imbalance of two men being alone together for too long.
The power relationship.
Yeah.
It's like father, son, and then it's almost like, there's almost like some homoeroticism at one point. One
for
goes in for a kiss, and but then and then it's just back to normal after that. And it's like, it is a strange movie for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But really, unlike anything you're going to see nowadays, I think, at the theater. So it's pretty cool. Like, it's almost like going to see a foreign film. Like, you're going to see a Bergman movie or something. But, like, with more strange horror elements, I guess. But
yeah, it's weird. Because I think it was shot on film. So it has that grainy quality. It's in black and white. So, like, that adds to the grain. But at the beginning, there's a scene of them watching the boat leave after it's dropped them off, and they're looking they're basically looking at the camera, and I had this like vision of like old wartimey footage, like from like the like World War I especially, where like seeing a camera, like a movie camera, was kind of like a new weird experience. So like people would be fascinated because they're looking right at the camera, and it's a point of view shot where they're looking out to sea. But part of me was like, is there a camera there? And they're like, they're watching the camera watch them.
Yeah,
it's very, very weird. It does feel like at times there is a fly on the wall aspect of this that you're
because he holds that shot so long before he turns around to show the boat leaving, right?
Yeah,
so you're kind of like, what's going on here? Why is it starting with them posing right away?
Like, yeah, it's a little uncomfortable, but it's interesting too, because I don't know if he's trying to say like, I don't know what inspired this, per se. I haven't done a lot of reading, but you know, if it was like sort of, you know, based on actual events, maybe that brings a sort of a documentary quality to it. Because there are also these long scenes where he's just showing what Robert Pattinson does in a day. These like menial chores of lugging the wood up to the lighthouse and fixing the building and having to bat away seagulls and it's like this incredibly. I don't know. It's like almost like this, like Eastern European, like worker porn, or like look how hard we toil. It's and then on top of it, there's this mystery of like what goes on up in the lighthouse, and why won't John Willem Dafoe let Robert Pattinson up to the lighthouse?
And he sees him like walking around naked up there and stuff. Yes. And he's like, what's going on up there?
Because there's this like weird sort of. I don't want to. I'm not sure if it's explicitly a love triangle, but it seems like it, that, you know, between Pattinson and Dafoe and the lighthouse. And like, there's a scene where you see Dafoe like in the light tower, like toasting the light.
Yeah.
Not the buoy, but like the light itself. And so like, what is this etherealness of the light? And why does goo come down when Robert Pattinson tries to sneak a peek about what goes on up there? And there's this there's a scene where he's like at the bottom of the staircase of the lighthouse, where he's like looking up, and the light from the lighthouse is coming down, and it's creating this like an unusual effect where it's kind of like a shimmering effect where it kind of distorts his face. And it's probably like the most explicit bit of like the allure of the light in the lighthouse, but it's like it's this enchantment. It's interesting.
It's like otherworldly, this light.
I think we need like a focus group to like watch this movie and like
figure
like,
it out.
You need to go in a film class somewhere. There needs to be a field
trip. It seems
trip.
Like a film class. Yeah, that's why it's like there's so many foreign films you'd watch in like a film class that you'd be like, okay, I don't quite get this, right? That are considered classics, right? You look at like Fellini movies or Bergman or what have you. And I think he's inspired by a lot of that. And I think he has a theater background too, which helps with the two-person constraints of that, two actors in a lighthouse, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's probably like some Samuel Beckett in there too. It's just very, you know, very sort of absurdist. And
and he also has a production design background too, Robert Eggers. So, I mean, the scenes are meticulous in terms of like how they're set up and you know, what artifacts are included. So, you know, there's a very distinct vision here. Mm-hmm. Very distinct.
Yeah. It's a tough movie if you want to like connect the dots and really know like what does this all mean, right? There's like a lot of symbolism and like really weird imagery, right? Mm-hmm. Like with the mermaid and with the seagulls too, like and just random acts of violence. But that makes it interesting and fun to watch. And Willem Dafoe, man, like this guy was like on fire in this movie. I hope.
Hope
he gets some credit for this, because he's just going for it, right?
Yeah. Well, Robert Pattinson too. Like Robert Pattinson's able to like meet the challenge, because Dafoe is so far out to sea. Like you need someone to sort of ground things, and that because it's a two person play, it falls onto Pattinson, and you know you have to sort of buy into his, you know. His desire to, you know, see what's up with the lighthouse, and his, you know, the drudgery he feels having to, you know, do all this hard labor. But at the same time, there's a weird thing too, where it's like, how much is the folk character like screwing around with him with like different stories about how his leg is messed up and like how he's like telling him like, oh, you'll be a Wookiee someday. You'll be up in the lighthouse in no time. And then on the other hand, you know, that he's writing in his law book, oh, this guy sucks. And, you know, he should dock his pay for this and fire him when this shift is over.
And then the movie's so strange and hard to, like, get your balance in. Like, how much is the Willem Dafoe character toying with him, or how much is a Robert Pattinson character just sort of losing his mind?
Yeah.
And maybe he's not even doing the work that they're showing him do. You know, like, yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of turns where I was trying to figure out, like, when does this all go wrong? Mm-hmm. Because for, like, 39 days, it's just, like, them working on the island, and it's, you know, it's sometimes antagonistic, but it's mostly, like, good, decent work, and then the 40th day, the storm comes, the boat doesn't come, and it all goes to blank, and, you know, so I'm sitting there trying to figure out, like, what's the demarcation point? Like, when do I start questioning what, like, really start to question what I'm seeing? And I have no idea. Because there are so many, like, places that, where he kind of has, like, these visions. Like, is he losing it? Or is this just, like, him having a bad dream? Did this ever really happen? Was this entire episode a bad dream? Because when you find out later on about, like, why he's there and what his background is, it's like, well, if you're... You want to get right down to the possibilities. Maybe he's not even there at all, and this is all in his head. It really is hard to grasp what is reality in this.
Yeah, and I think that's a really cool thing for a movie to do, right? Mm-hmm. I watched like Mulholland Drive recently. When I saw it back when it first came out, I was kind of like, I was with a friend, and he was blown away by it, and I'm kind of like. Okay, yeah, it's cool. David Lynch, cool, and, you know, but then I watched it again recently, and I'm like, wow, you know, I still don't know what it's all about. I don't know all the connections, but it's like there's something here, there's something there. Maybe a movie like this, you watch it again, and it does allow for repeat viewings to see maybe there's something here, maybe there's something there.
There is something Lynchian to it, now that you've mentioned that, and a lot of David Lynch movies are like that. I remember watching Lost Highway. Mm-hmm. And I was like, kind of like Krusty the Clown at the end. What the hell is that? And then you sort of watch it again, and you can sort of see where the things that David Lynch wants you to see, or that, you know, I guess wants you to pay attention to, and you can sort of start to navigate it. And I think that's also dependent on, you know, what you take with you into the movie, and how the trailers set you up. And, you know, coming out of The Witch, which was Robert Eggers' first movie, and it was also his last movie, where it's also about isolation, where it's also about people going mad, where it's also about people going mad who maybe don't know they're going mad, and how that's an influence on the people around them. And there's also the aspect of questioning reality. There's also, like, the sort of the anthropomorphized demon animal, and in The Witch it's the goat, and in this it's the seagull.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all kind of turns on, you know, the fate of the animal. Like, once the animal's fate is dictated, then everything else starts to fall apart. I wonder if he's a vegetarian. Now that I'm thinking about it, or a vegan or something. Yeah.
But if he is, I definitely hope no seagulls were harmed in the making of this.
Let's just say, if you are triggered by animal cruelty, there is one scene, because even, like, I'm not necessarily that, but I was taken aback at how long that scene went on with the seagull.
Yeah.
And Pattinson.
Pattinson, and just his anger just keeps going and going.
But I think it was thoroughly enjoyable.
It was.
And I think, like, nobody, I saw it with us, there was a small group of people in the theater, and nobody got up when the lights went up. Mm-hmm. Everyone was kind of stunned.
Yeah.
Stunned into, wait, is that the end?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess we'll go home now.
Yeah, somebody in the screen I was in, he just sort of shouted out, that was bizarre and disturbing.
That seems like a good place to leave things on, so we'll call it there. Anyway, that is it for the show this week. We hope you liked it. If you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or you can go through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media too, Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, and Twitter, End Credits Radio. And Tim, where can people find you on the internet?
All social media, Flash in the Deadpan. And find me there.
Find me there, you scurvy dog. Anyway.
Yeah.
You can find me on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics and open source Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.